is the podcast for women who know stuff. My name is Charlotte Lydia Riley.
And I'm Emma London. And the previous episode we talked about workplace politics,
yes,
mindfulness and all sorts of that things like that. But maybe we should start this episode by talking about what people have been saying about us. Because
yes,
we're always trying to get people to leave us comments and send us emails and stuff.
And people actually have.
They have,
some
yes.
Some people have.
We've had some, one of my absolute favourite things is from Sophie Cooper on Twitter, who said, subscribe and listen now. It's highly unlikely, almost impossible, that you'll regret it. She said that after she listened to our first episode.
That's,
I think that's
very high praise.
Very high praise.
I know Emily Bourne, also on Twitter, has said that it's a good podcast to listen to running because apparently we come in through separate headphones, which I find hilarious. I love the idea that we're sitting on either shoulder when you're running along.
I really like the idea that I'm going for runs because I'm still not able to physically.
Vicarious exercise.
Yeah.
And she also had some good ideas about why Theresa May might have worn a Frida Kahlo bracelet to do with the depoliticisation of women and the idea that women are fundamentally seen as not political actors.
Which I think is really fascinating, seeing as it's, I mean, I think it's true.
I think it's true.
Definitely a very good point. It wouldn't really have come to me because I've brainwashed myself into thinking of women as fundamentally very political creatures.
Mm-hmm.
But also, particularly this case where it's a female politician, right?
Yeah.
A female prime minister.
Absolutely.
Wearing
who is depoliticizing
by a famous political artist.
Yes.
It's just incredible. But hey, that's what happens to women in the public eye, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Emily, anyway, for pointing that out to us.
And I think we also should maybe give an honourable mention to A Modern Dandy on
mm-hmm.
Twitter, who suggested that we make you reading poems a regular feature, and then quite quickly backtracked saying that he didn't want us to think that he was suggesting stuff out of turn. But we basically had come to that conclusion ourselves. But I thought it was really nice.
Yes, I like the idea that men are frightened to tell us what to do.
Yes.
I think that's very on brand for this podcast.
It's very on brand.
It should definitely continue.
Yes. So today,
we're continuing this conversation about women and work, aren't we? But we're thinking a bit more about emotional labour, which we kind of started to talk about last episode.
Yes.
Although quickly, I think, started to talk instead about harassment and various other issues as well.
Yes. And I think before we start getting into it properly, we need to talk about what emotional labour actually is, because
yes,
I think there's a general, quite a large section of the population have
mm-hmm.
various definitions for it that I don't necessarily agree with. I think a lot of people assume that it's to do with anything that women do.
Yes, and I think
including stuff in the home, which
yes,
it's not necessarily. What would you, how do you define it, Charlotte?
Well, I think you're right. There's been a big conflation recently, so there's been pieces written and things about emotional labour, which have basically conflated emotional labour and domestic labour. So people have started talking about looking after children as emotional labour. And that work has an emotional component because it's a caring role, which has an emotional, you know, which has an emotional element. But that's not emotional labour because it's also just work. Looking after children is work. Cleaning is work. Food shopping is work. Cooking is work. All of those things are just labour. And I think where emotional labour comes in is, firstly, it doesn't have to happen in domestic spaces, and actually I'm probably more interested in it happening in official workplaces. And also that it's about the kind of management of emotions or the performance of emotions as part of a work role. So the example that I would have in my own work is that as an academic, I'm a teacher, as well as being a researcher. And so part of my job is to not just kind of provide pastoral support for students, which has an emotional component, because often you're dealing with students who are quite upset or who have emotional problems, but also more generally, by being a young woman in a workplace, I'm assumed to be better at dealing with emotional problems. And I think that's where the emotional labour comes into it, that I'm essentially expected to perform this on top of my existing role.
Yes, isn't it? It's a great element to it that is invisible as mm-hmm. well.
Yes,
that it's
invisible.
It's an assumption. It's also an assumption that it's a personal interest.
Yeah.
And that it happens seamlessly.
Yes. I mean, and it's not something that we have to work at.
Exactly.
Either.
It's just a sort of innate skill.
Yeah.
That's not true. If anyone's listening and think that we agree with that, I don't think it's true.
I mean, there were also, there's been bits and pieces of writing about emotional labour. There was a really good, very, very long kind of comment forum thread on it a while ago, which we'll put a link to on our website, where people were talking about different issues around emotional labour. And there certainly are elements in which it does happen in domestic spaces. So one of the examples that was given, for example, is sort of remembering to send birthday cards.
Yes.
And that this is a really good example, I think, because this is something that it's not work, it's not paid. There's a social expectation, perhaps, that you would send birthday cards, but it's not, you know, it's not something that is ever really monetized or kind of even really demanded. It's sort of expected. But the way in which this becomes emotional labour particularly is in, for example, heterosexual couples where the woman ends up being the person who is responsible not only for buying the birthday card, but also for remembering the birthday card, for writing in the birthday card, for posting it, not just for her friends and family, but for her partner's friends and family as well.
Yeah. I have to say, if anyone wants to role model in this, I'm happy to put myself forward as one, because I have I've delegated all the birthdays that I'm not have that I don't have a direct DNA connection to, I don't deal with. I don't buy the gifts. I mean, I'm happy to, you know, come along and do the shopping, but the thinking, someone else is going to have to do, because it's just too much for one person to deal with.
It's the thinking as well. I think it's the thinking and the caring that's the emotional labour part. So lots of women I've seen writing about this, for example. It's also kind of reinforced by family expectations, so that, for example, women talk about their husband's family, maybe their husband's mother, for example, approaching them rather than their husband to ask about things like birthday plans.
Yeah.
Women often end up acting as essentially secretaries for their husbands, managing their social engagements, thinking about what's in the diary that week, continually reminding their partner what they have to do.
Yeah.
You know, remember to call your mother and wish her happy birthday at the weekend, that kind of thing, which isn't work, but which is work, which is emotional labour, essentially. Yeah. But is also insidious because it's never explicitly demanded.
It's also, it's a kind of status quo creating or upholding mm-hmm. element as well in your life, in that it's just assumed that it happens. It's like one of these things that if you went on strike, that would very easily be, you know, your work would be quite easily identified. Yeah, there.
Exactly.
There's a really good cartoon by, oh god, now I can't remember
it's her
name.
The French
one,
yes.
You should have asked, it's called. It's by Emma. Yes. I don't actually know if she has a surname. She probably has a surname, but she's on the internet as Emma.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent name. And she's illustrating how some men, should be added maybe, but many men, most men, assume that they will be asked to do stuff if they have to do stuff.
Absolutely.
And it's, she's, the cartoon starts with Emma visiting a co-worker, mm-hmm. her boss maybe, who has two young children, and she's cooking Emma a meal.
Yes.
And she's trying to deal with feeding the kids while cooking. Her husband comes in, sits down and chats to their guest, and then having a really nice conversation. And meanwhile, there's a big catastrophe happening in the kitchen, and it ends with, you know, everything overflowing and the big chaos, and the husband saying, "But you should have asked."
Yeah,
and I think that's quite it was quite eye-opening, actually.
It's interesting because on my 1960s course, actually, that I teach my second years in my job, I was talking about supermarkets. Supermarkets come to Britain in the 1960s, and they're important for lots of things. You know, women going into the workplace need more convenience foods. But there's lots of data that's compiled that shows in the 60s and 70s, you know, less than 10% of men regularly help with the weekly shop, for example. quite recently there was a kind of a viral example of a husband-proof shopping list that went viral, which I think was a woman in India had written a shopping list for her husband that was apparently husband-proof, you know, that really explicitly detailed every single thing he had to buy and described the packaging and things.
Mm.
And this assumption that, you know, there has been a shift, of course, in men taking over more domestic labour. You know, men are much more active in childcare than they were in the 40s, 50s, 60s. Men are, you know, much more responsible for and capable of childcare, housework, domestic labour. But I think often for many people, where the shift hasn't happened is in the kind of scheduling and knowing and deciding that men traditionally, and it is, you know, it's worth saying, not all, absolutely not all men, hashtag not all men. But there is this kind of assumption that women still kind of manage households and delegate tasks. Because this labour is essentially still feminised, and so it's delegated to men who are more than happy to do it, but who often do not take that kind of further step of just identifying things that need to be done. I need to confess here that I am a terrible housewife, and that my partner does almost all of the housework, I would say. with some key differences. I do the laundry and I do the cooking. But
I do laundry. I don't do cooking. I've delegated all of the cooking. I quite like cooking.
Do you wash up?
And we have a dishwasher. No. I was just about to say we have a dishwasher, but I don't deal with that either.
My partner is actually a very good cook and a very capable cook, but I get home earlier. And I'm greedier as well, so think about food more during the day. But it's always interesting. It's emotional labour in the home, obviously, has the extra dimension. You know, we'll talk about emotional labour in the workplace in a minute, but emotional labour in the home it's more emotional, you know. It's because you can't really, I mean, you could go on strike, absolutely, but it's more emotional. It's about your relationship to people. It becomes bound up with love as well. It becomes bound up with the emotion of living with someone, the emotion of managing your home and your family.
And you know how they say all of the relationship experts are people argue about money and chores.
And chores, exactly. And, you know, and the point about emotional labour in the home, I think, is this kind of remembering that some of it doesn't need to be done. Some of this remembering probably doesn't need to happen, and some of this is about, but there's a really Sam Binney, the novelist, has a bit in one of her books about a woman being kind of mocked for writing one of those family newsletters that goes on out at Christmas that we used to occasionally get. My mum would always mock when I was a kid. But she points out that that's quite important for her. She thinks that's important emotional labour because it keeps people connected, networked.
Yes.
And she says, you know, all of these men, elderly men whose wives die, and they end up kind of alone and lost because they haven't personally kept up these relationships with friends and things. And actually, you know, often when we talk about emotional labour, it's about people, women doing less of it, but often actually what needs to happen is that men need to do more.
Yes, and I think this is one of the things that, having had a baby myself, I was quite surprised at how, you know, we came to it thinking about continuing the gender equality that sort of lives in my house, and that it would somehow be much easier to do because we were both aware of the fact that we wanted to be equal. But in the end, because I was the one who was at home for the first 6 months, pretty much on my own, what I recognised in Emma's cartoon about the emotional labour side of domestic labour is the difficultness in delegating.
Yes.
And being, when you're that exhausted, and I was also the only one who fed our baby, which I suppose was a personal choice, but it's also a biological factor that you can't really deal with in mixed gender relationships and parenting. It was quite interesting how it is actually, some of that becomes, in a way, biologically, it becomes a kind of biological law, I suppose, that you follow. Because I sat there, I mean, I was watching Gilmore Girls most of the time, but I was sitting there thinking about what needed to be done.
Yes.
And then I would have to, you know, delegate lots of those things. But in the end, often I felt like the planning side of things was the most difficult to delegate. Yes, because absolutely. If I had to delegate that, I had to think about an extra step.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just thinking, I need to go and book a GP appointment to have injections done. I actually had to then also tell someone about. And it was quite mind-opening and eye-opening to think that there is, like, some of this is kind of coded into tired behaviour, mm-hmm. and that you just end up, it's a very slippery, quite appealing slope at times, because it's just so much easier.
Well, also because there is a kind of, you know, and again, in the workplace this happens as well, there is a language of emotional labour being something that women are better at, right? There is an idea, and this is obviously demonstrably false, but there is a kind of language of women being better at emotional labour, and women are certainly socialised to believe that that's true, and that often does make them, sometimes that socialisation does mean that women are, find it easier to be empathetic, for example, or find it easier to talk about emotions in a way that might make that helpful. And the problem there is that sometimes it can be hard to relinquish that because it's an area in which women have expertise.
Yes.
And so then you get this really complicated relationship with it where it's something that you're doing and you're doing well.
Mm.
And I think, you know, for women sometimes in, we're particularly women in heterosexual relationships, you know, it becomes a point of pride that they are doing this management, that they are managing the house like that.
And I have something to add to that, because I then, when I was thinking a lot about this, and I think it might have been in the spring, so when I had just started to work and I was working maybe 2-3 days a week, we didn't really have proper childcare arrangements. My daughter wasn't in nursery. So I had to kind of deal with working when I could get someone to look after the child, but actually working probably 50% of the week. I read a really good interview with Lisa Wade, who is a sociologist in the US. She's at Occidental College in LA, and she sort of scoffs at the idea that women are better at the emotional labour and the planning and stuff. And she says, well, people do tend to get good at the things they do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Our brains are beautiful like that. It's all about context. Women are better at sewing because they have such nimble fingers and they're so patient. But if it's a surgeon, it should be a dude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And I thought that was quite, you know, it is practice, and I think that makes it easier to delegate in a way, because it's not that I'm relinquishing power.
No.
It's that someone else is training to see the problem. And I have to say, I mean, my partner listens to this podcast. This isn't really about him as much as, you know,
this is about structural issues.
The general man.
I mean,
because my actual partner is very helpful and does probably more than his fair share in the house, because I need to work. He works part time and stuff like that. But
I mean,
this
is all kind of connected to as well. You know, we said at the beginning, emotional labour and domestic labour aren't the same thing.
Mm.
And it's important to remember, you know, domestic labour is just work that you do in the home, and that's not gendered. But the sort of the queen of this is the sort of the woman who really first gave voice to this is Ali Hochschild in her book, The Second Shift.
Yes.
Which is an excellent book that I would absolutely recommend, which examines, you know, this kind of very pervasive idea that women go out into the workplace in the, you know, well, actually in the First World War, and then again in the Second World War, and then after the Second World War, women remain in the workplace in higher numbers. The marriage bar falls off in various industries, and so, you know, you get to a point in the 1980s, 1990s where women are working, but women aren't relinquishing the second shift. So women are coming home and doing housework.
Yeah.
And again, you know, there's data from the 1960s that shows that women in the 60s were doing about 6.5 hours of housework a day. And actually, into the 1980s, that data doesn't really shift. So women are doing about the same amount of housework. And one of the reasons...
And about 4 hours of sleep,
and
I
about
presume.
4 hours of sleep. And one of the reasons why that level stays so high, because people are often surprised by how high that is even in the 60s, because the 60s is the decade of the washing machine and the Hoover and, or not the Hoover, what's the non-brand name? The vacuum cleaner. And, you know, freezers and fridges and convenience food. So you would think that people would be doing less housework than that, but actually housework becomes more productive, but it doesn't take less time.
Mm.
Having a washing machine doesn't actually make you spend less time doing laundry. It just means you are able to get more laundry done. You know, before people had washing machines, women would do a wash for an entire day every couple of weeks, and you just had to wear your clothes when they were dirty until that point.
Yes.
The expectations of what, how much housework you do shifts.
Yeah.
When things become mechanised and...
I read the tenancy agreement for an estate. I can't remember which estate, but an estate in southeast London, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been the Haygate, actually, when people were first moving on to the Haygate. There was, in the tenancy agreement, that you needed to wash your windows once a week.
My God.
Which is like, it happens twice a year in my house, if we're lucky.
I'm trying to remember when I
That's because I do it.
This, no, it's...
I would do it more often, but I just don't have the
time.
Well,
and there are lots of things bound up with this as well, of kind of respectability as well. And, and actually, working class families have always had a very complicated relationship with that kind of domestic labour because of the need to prove respectability.
Yes.
You know, in the very classic image, for example, of women scrubbing their front steps.
Yeah.
Because you need to look clean. If you're living in poverty, you need to do something to demarcate yourself. And often that's housework.
Yeah.
And so it's, again, it's an area where women have power and expertise.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, backbreaking and difficult.
And it's something that non-women can learn.
Yes, exactly. But I think actually the point... the point that Lisa Wade made about it being a learned behaviour, actually, it also explains... It does explain why it doesn't get handed over.
Mm.
Because you need to take the time to learn to do it. And and you need to... You know, women often... You often see women talking about, you know, well, I could teach my husband how to do whatever it is that he doesn't know how to do. Which, to be quite honest, if he's an adult, then presumably he can do all of these things. It's not, you know, none of this stuff is particularly complicated.
Yeah.
But the idea that you'd have to sort of teach them and then suffer through... If you teach someone how to cook, you then have to suffer through bad meals.
Yeah.
Until you get to a point where it's actually
I have to say, I started to cook for my family when I was a teenager.
Yeah, me
so
too.
My original family. And part of that was because I don't like sausages. And I realised that the person who cooks could ensure that there wasn't ever any sausages on the menu. So if my parents are listening to this, that's the reason. But it's, you know, I at this point in my life, I'm more than happy to relinquish the control over the menu and everything else and just eat what I'm being served, and that is such a luxury.
It's deciding. It's deciding what you eat. That's the problem.
I think
love cooking. I love making food.
Yeah.
I don't like looking into a fridge and deciding what we should have for dinner.
Yeah, no.
That's the bit of the labour that I find particularly grueling. And trying not to have the same five things.
Yeah.
Over and over again. Like, actually sitting down and cooking is easy.
Yeah, I hear that's true. I haven't cooked very much over the past year and a half, but...
Have a tiny child.
I do have a tiny child, but, you know, her dad cooks every day, several times a day.
Fair enough.
And he then clears up all the entire kitchen, and, I'm very well looked after.
I think we... So, you know, we talked at the beginning about how emotional labour and domestic labour are not the same thing, and how, you know, this is kind of... Domestic labour has an emotional element to it, but actually emotional labour in the workplace...
Yeah.
I think is another area that becomes... There was an article in The Guardian a little while ago, actually, but it kind of re-emerged, as articles often do online, and got a whole kind of extra level of anxiety about it, because it said that women in academia don't get promoted because they spend too much time doing work that's not rewarded by promotion committees, by kind of hierarchies of management. And I think I pointed out, and quite a few people pointed out, that actually the correct headline for this would be, women are not rewarded for the work that they do.
Yeah.
Because the work that apparently women devote so much time to in academia that means that they don't get promoted is essentially emotional labour. It was, and also kind of administrative work as well, administrative labour, organisational work.
Yeah.
And
planning and foreseeing things.
Planning and foreseeing things, dealing with things, managing people's time, managing people's
expectations
and personalities, you know, doing a lot of the work around the kind of research and publishing that apparently men focus on, and that's what gets them promoted. Mm. What the article didn't point out was that it is easier within a workplace environment for men to refuse to do that work, for men to be difficult, or for men to do it so badly that they're not asked to do it frequently, which is not an unusual tactic, I think, among men in academia. Women are told they're just better at that work, and yeah. of course they're better at, you know, I've had various people tell me that I'm very organised.
Oh, yes.
I'm so organised. And yeah. so it's, you know, excellent that I do these things. I've also been told that, you know, women are better at managing people. By academics who would think of themselves, by male academics who would think of themselves as, you know, great allies to feminism and women in general. And if, when women choose not to do that work, if women choose not to be emotionally supportive, if women choose not to let you talk about your feelings in the coffee room, or if they choose not to do the administrative labour around things, or not to volunteer to do open days or whatever it is, they don't get the benefit that men do, because they get seen as being cold or difficult,
yeah,
or generally problematic.
Yeah. So women are meant to act in a particular way, which includes an like enormous capability for emotional labour, which is meant to happen without challenging the system for us at all.
Yes.
And if we don't, then we'd sort of get slapped with the diagnosis.
Cold.
Almost. Yes.
Cold. The worst thing you can be as a woman in the workplace is cold. Difficult or cold, I think.
Yeah.
And also this kind of idea that because it's not seen as work,
yeah,
it's seen as something that women are naturally good at.
It's a sort of little, it's almost at the stage of a hobby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
That this is like, she's always meeting with students after hours because she's so, you know, she enjoys the conversations. Yeah, yeah, that might very well be true, but it's actually also part of the job and part of what your university, your employer would want you to have these absolutely. Conversations. You and of want course, your students to succeed, don't you?
And of course, as a young woman in academia, for many reasons, you might be more approachable.
Yeah.
Than other people. So you might find yourself dealing with more of these student inquiries, or, which is, you know, of, I like teaching, I love working with my students, but the labour is not always shared equally.
No, it's true. I always start off meeting new student groups by sort of pointing out all the facilities that are available to them should they need them, mm-hmm. and the fact that it should be difficult to be at university, but it shouldn't be absolutely impossible. So if you're finding it impossible, there's probably someone you need to go and see and talk about yeah. the reasons for it. And I think that starts, it's a sort of start for many conversations
yeah,
around
absolutely.
That, where then, you know, people feel comfortable talking to me about these things. Yeah. Whereas I feel like a fair amount of male colleagues don't even really think about it. They might, you know, print something at the end of the syllabus or the course handbook or something and kind of leave it at that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great advantage to the modern university that there is a lot of support for students.
Yeah.
But it is being shouldered by a particular member of staff.
The other reason that this is really important is that we know that women tend to do worse in student evaluations.
Yes.
And we know this because there have been experiments done on online courses where you are effectively taught by a computer, you know, you don't know whether the person you're interacting with is male or female, and half of the students were told that the instructor was male and half of the students were told the instructor was female, but they were treated exactly the same. And the male instructor, you know, male instructors always generally, but in this case as well, I think, was described, you know, in these kind of glowing intellectual terms, so described as being a genius. The woman was often described as being kind or helpful. But also when it came to kind of rating the two, I think I'm conflating various studies here, but on the one with the online anonymous teachers, the thing that really stood out to me was that students rated the supposedly female instructor much lower for things like speed of turnaround of feedback.
Oh, really?
Even though they were treated exactly the same, it literally just came down to whether they were told they were being taught by a woman or a man. Because the expectation is that women will be more caring.
Oh, interesting.
And so when they behave the same, women come off worse.
Interesting. One of the reasons I like working at Queen Mary, which is my main employer and has been for the past 3 years, is that we get to write a response to student evaluations, which is excellent, because my students, bless them, tend to say nice things about me.
Yes.
But in the spring, I had, like, I taught 45 students across one module, and there were like 5 comments calling me lovely, mm-hmm. which is great, very nice, but it made me a little bit angry as well, because it makes it sound to my employer maybe as though I'm some sort of pushover, which yeah. anyone who knows me and has been in my classroom, I'm definitely no pushover.
Definitely. The idea that you're actually serious.
Exactly. But I mean, the same people had often said really, really good things about my brain as well, or how I teach and how much they had enjoyed the module and things. So that's nice. But I really appreciated the opportunity to write in mm-hmm. my response. My students have used very gendered language mm-hmm. in their student evaluations of this module. And I want to point out that, you know, I make it clear to them within 10 seconds of them sitting down in the classroom that I know who have prepared and who haven't.
I mean, we talked a little bit in the first episode of this, no, second episode of this podcast about women and clothes at work.
Oh, yeah.
And I have heard anecdotally from lots of younger women in academia, or earlier career women in academia, that their clothes often come up in evaluations.
Oh, really?
Yes, yeah, so they're described, not, you know, often not negatively, but are described in terms of their appearance. Mm. I also have heard anecdotally of women being described as young women in mm. feedback, or a kind of grudging respect as well, you know, even though they are, you know, I thought that they wouldn't be very good, but actually, which my male colleagues have never reported to me. Perhaps they're just not telling me about the negative feedback they get, but I suspect that that's very gendered as well.
Yeah.
And I think the kind of focus on emotional labour in the workplace is also, you know, Lucy Robinson at the University of Sussex, I've heard speak about this before, and she says, you know, it's about what our employers are getting for free from us.
Yeah.
That women are providing something, or expected to provide something, as a kind of extra element of their job that they're not remunerated for, and then they're not kind of even really praised for, because it's seen as being something that we're naturally good at.
Yeah. It's just like a permanent factor in our lives that we look after mm-hmm. others.
Yeah. And then that seems being part of your job in the workplace and your job work in the home. You know, and it's exactly the same language that leads to men being described as babysitting their own children. the assumption that we have a particular kind of skill or ability or desire to do any of this stuff.
Yes. And I feel, I mean, again, I'm Swedish, and I grew up in a country where parental leave is split much better mm-hmm. than it is here. If you're in my home city in Sweden, you often see men. I mean, it's really common. They're just like men pushing buggies everywhere, and they mm-hmm. are men who have parental leave. So the kids tend to be a little bit older. I suppose most mums stay at home for the first 6 months or so, mm-hmm. particularly if you breastfeed, it's difficult to hand over your child for long periods of the day without it. But it's this assumption that men can do it,
mm-hmm.
right? So society's kind of changed its perception of what a dad can do mm-hmm. without, I don't know, having a university degree in child rearing. I don't know what, you know, but and then you come to Britain, and it's still, you know, when I say that I work 5 days a week, my partner works 4 days a week, he's mm-hmm. at home with the child 1 day a week. The amount of times that people mishear it as, so they assume that I'm the one who works part-time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like 80% of the time, at least. And it's, you know, still surprising to people that he would sacrifice a day at work or something. And
I mean, it's also really, I mean, in Britain, it's obviously really structural, because it's only quite recent that people have been able to share the parental leave. But also because there is a gender pay gap,
yeah.
often it financially makes sense yeah. for women to take more time off, because every day sacrificed by a man tends to be worth more money.
And it's the same in Sweden, actually. So the Swedish law is very generous. You have 480 days of mm-hmm. paid parental wow. leave. Most people have, I think, about 80 or 90% of their basic salary during mm. that time. So, you know, it's not a financial catastrophe for Swedish couples. But it's still the case. I mean, there's a gender gap in Sweden. So men make more money, so men yeah. are less likely to stay at home. But they do have a mandated 90-day quota. So there are 90 days that only women can take and 90 days that only men can take.
Mm.
And if the men don't take those 90 days, you lose them.
This is...
So I think it's, you know, as we start talking about how to solve issues and how to start delegating, a lot of that is to just, you know, put the... make the other half do it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
A lot of that is to just push them in the quotas because... There seemingly is no other solution because every other solution has been trialled.
And the thing is, and it just has a knock-on effect on so many areas as well, because once you normalise men having parental leave, then you also reduce the stigma of women taking parental leave.
Exactly.
As well as the stigma of men
taking
parental leave.
Surely it's the only solution.
And you take away the expectation that women will take parental leave, so you remove a lot of those problems with kind of lean-in feminism that we talked about in the last episode, that, you know, there are lots of assumptions made about young women that they will go and have babies and that they are irresponsible, you know, not irresponsible, sort of irresponsible hires by employers because the possibility
they will be
of them
costly
going
they will cost
costly,
more
exactly.
than their salary.
Once you start to say no, actually men and women who have children cost the same, then it gets rid of a lot of that.
One of the really frustrating things I have realized since having a child is that there is statistically women are punished for having children, so our careers plateau or stagnate and we start the gender gap increases dramatically as women reach the ages of like 28 or 30. Up until then, young women tend to make more money than men, at least in Britain. But men becoming fathers has the opposite impact on men's careers. So they are rewarded in their careers for being fathers because they are then seen to be a stable member of the workforce.
Yeah.
So whereas women having children turns the assumption on, you know, you being flimsy or you can't be, you know, assumed to be in the office all the time, it's the opposite for men.
Yeah.
And it's shocking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of it is the shock is that it's so obvious.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I mean, it's... Yeah, what should we do? Should we force them to stay at home, Charlotte?
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do that. We're mandating a new law in Britain where all men have to take at least 6 months at home with every child. I think that's the only solution forward.
Good. I suppose I should have a poem, really, shouldn't I?
You should have a poem.
I know there are lots of poems about motherhood and children and things. Actually, the poem I was going to recommend this time is not... It's more about... it's about female bodies... and it's a sort of extended piece of writing by Margaret Atwood about female bodies. And I'm not going to read it all out. No one needs to hear me reading out a long poem.
I think we do, but we might save a few minutes by posting a link.
Yes, exactly. She has this long bit on the female body. It's a five-part. It's, you know, obviously not new. It has seven parts to it. But the bit that I thought really fitted with emotional labour was the idea of female bodies contain a female brain. Female brains have two halves and these are joined like a conversation. Women listen and they listen in, and men's brains are separated. They're good for aiming, for hitting targets when you pull triggers. And she, in her writing, says that this is why men feel so cut off and why they think of themselves as orphans cast adrift, footloose and stringless in the deep void. What void, she asks? What are you talking about? The void of the universe, he says, and she says, oh, and looks out the window. So I liked the idea that maybe emotional labour at least connects women in a way that men maybe feel kind of isolated.
That's very true, particularly when we think about it in terms of keeping in touch with relatives and other friends.
Building
that
networks.
We talked about before.
Yes, and that's why, you know, emotional labour, it's not that people should stop doing it, it's that it's really important. It connects us as a society, but it's about fairness.
Yeah, and I was going to say women shouldn't hog it, but seriously, men just need to do it.
Particularly in the workplace.
Yes, they would feel so much happier if they did.
Yes, exactly.
So we've come towards the end of this now, so here comes our recommendations, and we're recommending feminist books.
Yes,
this week.
This is very exciting. What's your recommendation?
Well, so I've only really been reading stuff in Swedish lately, so this is going to be a Swedish recommendation. It's a book by a journalist called Caroline Heiner, and it's called... Let me think if I actually remember what it's called. I mean, it's a bit irrelevant for anyone who doesn't speak Swedish, but it has quite a rude title. It's called Män visa kuken för mig, and it means Men show me their dick.
Excellent.
And it's about dick pics. It's a like socio-anthropological study of dick pic. It started with her being on some dating app, and all of a sudden someone had sent her a dick pic completely out of the blue and uncalled for, and she dissects her reaction to this and then goes into what it could possibly mean. Who sends it? Why are they doing it? What's the purpose? And why do women and men have such different ideas about it?
That's incredible.
So hopefully, I mean, I can try to translate it, but everyone should read it.
You should offer your services to translate it.
I might do that.
I mentioned to a man the other day that on Twitter you get your messages for people who follow you and then people who don't. And messages from people who I don't follow, pictures are hidden because you don't follow them, so you have to click on them to reveal the picture. And the other day I had a message from a man I didn't follow, and there was a media attachment that was hidden because I didn't follow him. And I mentioned this, and I talked about the sort of this feeling at the bottom of your stomach kind of trepidation of clicking on that picture. Yeah. And it turned out that it was a screen grab of, I mean, it was still offensive, it was a screen grab of a tweet that I'd sent that he wanted to tell me he disagreed with. But yes, the idea that it might have been a dick pic was horrific. So my recommendation is a slightly cheeky recommendation because it's the book that I actually have an essay in. But it's a book called Under My Thumb, which is edited by Ellie Davis and Rhianne Jones. And the subtitle of this book is Songs That Hate Women and the Women Who Love Them. And it's 26 essays, all by women, about problematic faves. Songs that are in some way anti-feminist or problematic for women who are feminists and why we love them anyway, or sometimes just bands. So there's lots of different things. There's an essay on Elvis Costello, and there's one on Weezer, and there's lots and lots of different things, and I think one on Pulp. And my essay is on Taylor Swift.
Oh, which song?
So just on her back catalogue up to 1989.
Okay.
About my journey from thinking that she was feminist and kind of kidding myself that she was feminist, and then deciding that she probably wasn't feminist, and then thinking about whether that mattered or not to me as a music fan. So yeah, that's my really self-serving recommendation. You should all
that's
go and
good.
Buy it.
That's good. We're always asking people to get in touch with us, and you know, if anyone wants to promote themselves,
yes, absolutely. Tell us what you want to promote,
and come and talk to us about their work,
absolutely.
Or send us links to things they've written. You are more than welcome.
Yes.
So next time we're going to be talking about health.
Yes.
So, yes, again, and if anyone has anything they want us to talk about, have you written
Absolutely.
Something about health, women and health, bodies? Have you got a body? Is it telling you something?
Yes,
are you
we
listening?
Talked about messy women's bodies in the first episode, I think, and we're going to talk more about that.
Yes.
About health, so anything that connects to that.
And as usual, we are on Twitter. It's probably the easiest way to get a hold of us.
Yeah.
You're going to have to do the
At TNK Pod, or our individual Twitter accounts, which are on our website, I think.
Yes.
And you can obviously download the podcast anywhere you can get podcasts.
Anywhere.
Wherever you found this one, in fact.
Exactly. And you should tell your friends and family and everything, everyone else about
and
it.
And give us reviews on iTunes.
Yes. And that's probably it for this week, isn't
it,
Sean?
Yes, that's
so
it, I think.
We'll speak to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.